Okay, my talk today it relates to climate change, but it's really all about what would happen if we replaced. Currently in the U.S., I think it's like 45% of the corn crop is actually dedicated to ethanol production. I mean, it used to be 30, and now this year I think it was 45%. And I've been working with British Petroleum and a number of different groups on this issue of biofuels and what happens if we could use biofuels, a perennial biofuel crops, switchgrass, miscanthus, crops like that, as an alternative to using the same amount of land that we currently are using for corn. So what is the consequence of changing 30%? You know, we did this last year when we did our analysis, but you know, we should have been using 45% if you want to know what currently is going on. It's sort of an amazing how much of the crop is going to ethanol. So basically, what happens if we don't use the current corn crop for ethanol, but use these perennials, sort of new generation ethanol potential? The problem with the current, with this analysis, in a sense, the analysis is correct, but basically the economics to support this system, it's not economically viable to do it. It might be viable in the sense of our knowledge about how to convert the biomass to ethanol, but it's certainly not economically viable. Okay, so where is corn grown for in the U.S.? See that big green area in the middle, the Corn Belt, as we certainly know in the U.S. And if you look there at those little red dots, you'll see where the ethanol plants are, and it's really highly overlapped with where the corn is, not surprisingly. There's a nice correlation between where the plants are and where the corn is produced. But clearly, it's the center of the U.S. where all of that, well, the mass majority of our corn is produced. Okay. I've been working with the University of Illinois group. They have, these are funded by British Petroleum Initiative with Berkeley also is associated, University of California, Berkeley. And some of the major crops they're looking at, they're comparing corn with miscanthus and soybeans. And that big green crop that you see there in those plots is miscanthus. It is an amazing crop, because it produces three or four times what switchgrass does. It grows, one of the main reasons is it grows for a lot longer growing season. If you look at the green crop, all the other crops are basically senesced, and miscanthus is growing way into November and starts earlier than all the rest. So one of the reasons it produces so much is that it's an extremely long growing season. A lot longer also than the grasses, like switchgrass, too. So this is what we'll talk about: model description, how did we do the assessment, calibration of the model, experimental design, basically replacing corn with switchgrass and miscanthus, model results and conclusions. Okay, the model that we used is called the DAYSENT model. This is the daily version of the SENTRY model, which has been used extensively during the last 20 to 30 years for soil carbon dynamics and crop production and ecosystem behavior. Basically, it's a full ecosystem model with plant production. The plants, you have dead plant material from the plant growth, goes into the soil organic matter. It has a detailed soil temperature and soil water model on a daily basis. We represent nitrification and denitrification. So we basically do the full greenhouse gas analysis, soil carbon, N2O, and methane, all of these modeled on a daily basis to predict the full greenhouse gas impact. Model calibration, compare the model with the NAS corn soybean yields at the U.S. county level. Switchgrass, miscanthus yield data we use to calibrate the model from a number of sites all over the country. Soil carbon data from Illinois on some of their plots. N2O from some sites in Pennsylvania. One of the amazing things about these perennial crops like switchgrass and canary grass, if you look at those, the switchgrass and canary grass, this is model versus data, but the key thing here is the model works, but also is that if you look at the N2O emissions from canary grass and switchgrass, compare that to corn, it's almost an order of magnitude smaller. Canary grass receives the same amount of fertilizer. I don't know why they're fertilizing that much, but they are. And it shows you that the perennial crops have much lower N2O emissions in spite of the fact that you fertilize them. And that's 2 years of data, and they show that. So the key thing with these perennials is that they're growing year-round, and they really reduce the N2O emissions and nitrate leaching massively, even when you fertilize them. That's a key part of the response. And this also shows you that basically we're getting the right yield. Well, we do get the right yield too, but we're also getting the right N2O. Miscanthus and switchgrass. This is our, in a sense, showing how well the model worked in the upper right-hand corner. The modeled growth with the switchgrass and miscanthus. You can again see those modeled grams carbon per meter squared. Almost 2,000 grams carbon yield with miscanthus versus like 400 for switchgrass. And then we show the yields predictions or the N2O emissions for different systems. The key thing again is these perennial grasses have very low N2O emissions. And this is a modeled yield for switchgrass for the central U.S. Versus miscanthus, basically out of the model. And you can clearly see the much higher yields with miscanthus. Okay, one of the things that we did in a paper recently by Sarah Davis showed that miscanthus basically does not need fertilizer to produce these high yields. It's fixing nitrogen. And all of the nitrogen it needs to get those yields. So we had miscanthus without fertilizer, switchgrass without and with fertilizer, and switchgrass with what are the standard fertilizer levels, which is about 70 kilograms of N per hectare per year. So it's a mid-level fertilizer, certainly a lot less than what we put on corn. But the miscanthus, we have no fertilizer. We had a 15-year experiment, Steve Long, where they had miscanthus yields the same for the whole time period, removing all the biomass, and there was no reduction in yield without fertilizer. Net greenhouse gas fluxes. So up in the upper left-hand corner, that's the corn with the current corn system. It's in red, indicating net greenhouse gas fluxes. You look over to B, there is a miscanthus simulation. That's all blue, which is basically uptake of its negative numbers. So we're basically taking reducing greenhouse gases from N2O and storing carbon in the soil. And the data from Illinois show massive amounts of carbon storage under miscanthus. We look at switchgrass alone on C, and it's pretty much neutral, though it's less greenhouse gases than we get from corn. And then if we have fertilized switchgrass, then we actually have a reduction in greenhouse gases, again due to carbon storage in the soil and reduced N2O emissions. So the key thing here is that with switchgrass, if you're going to be growing it, you need to fertilize. You can't just mow the system and take it away continually for long time periods because you're taking away the nitrogen and you reduce the carbon storage. So fertilizer is necessary if you're going to be managing for switchgrass production. Nitrate leaching, A on the left, that's with the current corn system. You move to the right, massive reductions in nitrate leaching. Then you go to the lower C one, which is switchgrass without fertilizer. It has the lowest nitrate leaching, which isn't surprising. But when you look at the full greenhouse gas balance, it actually it's a lot better off to have switchgrass with fertilizer. And the switchgrass with fertilizer has higher, somewhat higher nitrate leaching than we get with the than we get with miscanthus. Again, miscanthus is fixing its own nitrogen and doesn't need to be fertilized. What I'd like to look at on this last diagram is the basically the soil column on the all the way on the right, and that gives the amount of carbon stored during the 10-year simulation. The top one is corn, 1.5, I forget, oh, teragrams of carbon. You look at miscanthus, you're up to 70. And, it's 15 versus 70. And so this is the massive storage of carbon due to the big root production with miscanthus. Then you can compare the panicum and with and without fertilizer. And basically, the carbon with panicum without fertilizer is about the same as maize, so actually a reduction in carbon. So you lost carbon when we just had switchgrass without fertilizer. Okay, what happens to the sort of total greenhouse gas for these different systems in terms of nitrate leaching? Maize, it's 3.2 teragrams of N per year. We go to miscanthus, 2.5. Switchgrass, 2.4, somewhat less. And then with fertilizer, 2.6. But in all of the perennial systems, you substantially reduce nitrate leaching. The net greenhouse gas balance, the switchgrass with fertilizer and the miscanthus have the best. And if you really wanted to reduce greenhouse gases, it would be a miscanthus. And the really big reason you get that is the massive carbon storage that you get under the miscanthus system. And if you look all the way on the right in the estimated ethanol production, you basically, under miscanthus in theory, could produce more gallons of ethanol than we currently are producing with that same land. And in all of the systems, we come up with about the same amount of ethanol that you could produce. So clearly, if this was a viable system economically, we could have massive environmental benefits of generating the same, if not more, ethanol from these biofuel crops. 2 more minutes, Bill. Yeah, thanks. Summary.
There you go.
Second-generation perennial feed crops can improve the ecosystem services from agriculture. Great reductions in greenhouse gases. In fact, we can go into the negative side. And the key thing that we assessed is that if you look at the indirect land use impact, you'll find that the greenhouse gas balance of using these perennial systems is substantially greater than this negative indirect land use of talking about corn potentially being grown in Brazil or places like that. We can actually compensate for that with this much bigger greenhouse gas benefits. Thank you.
We have time for a question. Go ahead, please.
My question is about annual greenhouse emission for corn field. Could you give me a number of per hectare corn field for annual nitrogen? How much is that per year?
How much?
From
corn fields, okay. Approximately 1% of the nitrogen that you apply is lost as N2O.
1%
of how much you fertilize, yes.
Okay.
Yes, Peter.
Yeah. Bill, you talked about how important the soil carbon storage was.
Right.
In Australia, we have farming systems that can build up soil carbon quite well, and then a drought comes. How secure are
those storages? Where they did these experiments for miscanthus, it was 15 years of this, so it wasn't You know, it was a net change over that time period. A lot of that change will occur in the first 20 years of transition. After that, you might not get more storage. But it is a transient pool, but it's a very big one. And Miscanthus, they have unbelievable number of roots. You talk about above-ground production being high, their root production is equally high.
Yeah, Robert, you have a question?
I just want to ask, well, what is the biological basis for this extraordinary productivity on the part of Miscanthus? And question related to the previous one, what's the water cost of that productivity?
Okay, there is a water cost that comes with it because they have really deep roots,
right.
and they use more water, and they grow over a longer growing season.
Right.
So basically, I don't have some numbers on it, but I mean, I would say it's probably 30% higher water use. I don't have that exact number. So there is more water use associated with it. And it's not clear that's bad because nitrate leaching and those things are an issue in the Midwest. What was the other part of that question?
What was the biological basis for the productivity? Where does that come from?
Well, it's just it's like a sugar cane. It's a crop that's just extremely productive in a temperate environment. And then we're investigating where the nitrogen fixation comes from. We're not exactly certain about the full mechanism there.
Okay, thanks, Prophet.